Hi, I'm Femi OK, back with a special bonus edition of The Stream. Today I'm digging through our show archives to bring you moments when sport and athletes took us beyond the games and into some serious social justice issues. Coming up, a cricket controversy, football failing to tackle racism, and stories of skiing while black. Let's rewind to September 2020. The Stream team was working from home, COVID vaccinations were still months away, and the killing of George Floyd earlier in the year had fired up a global Black Lives Matter movement. Athletes were protesting too, but some fans complained that activism was ruining sport. Here's how the WNBA's Jantel Lavender, basketball player Maxwell Pierce, and sports editor Dave Zirin dealt with the criticism.
When people say that they don't want sports and politics to mix, what they're really saying is they don't want sports and a certain kind of politics to mix. They have no problem with politics and sports when we're talking about nationalism, when we're talking about celebrating the military, heck, when we're talking about celebrating the police. Many teams do these celebrations of law enforcement nights and or whatnot. But when it comes to the athletes themselves trying to use the platform that they have built, that they have earned to speak out about their lives, then all of a sudden the hammer comes down. And there is, I would argue, a seriously racist undertone or sometimes overtone to this statement, which is basically shut up and play, which is basically get out there and entertain me and I don't want to hear what you have to say. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that in 2020 we're still wrestling with what was said in 1968 when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists. One of their slogans for the 68 Olympics was they said, "Why should we run in Mexico City only to crawl home?" Which is still what animates, I think, the athletic protests today. Why should we be loved with our uniforms on but then disdained when the uniform is off?
Mm. Let me just show you Naomi Osaka. She won the US Open on September the 12th. And these images, people were waiting every day. What mask is she going to wear? Have a look here on my laptop and you can see it. And she is wearing the mask of people who met a violent end because of police brutality. Every day she had a Black Lives Matter movement mask on. And then at the end of the US Open, when she won it, this is what she told the commentator who asked her about the mask.
"You said from the beginning you had seven matches, seven masks, seven names. What was the message you wanted to send, Naomi?"
Well, what was the message that you got? Was more the question. I feel like the point is to make people start talking.
What were you most gratified about the awareness that you raised?
I've been inside of the bubble, so I'm not really sure what's really going on the outside world. All I can tell is what's going on social media. And for me, I feel like, you know, the more retweets it gets, or that's so lame, but, you know, the more people talk about it.
Jantel, what's it like being a female athlete, seeing other athletes all working together to the same end? When you saw Naomi do that, Maxwell, I know you tweeted out Naomi's success on your Twitter account as well. Jantel, you go first. Maxwell, you go second.
Well, it's phenomenal. And she's on one of the biggest stages that you can ask for in the sports community. And to see her speaking out, it lets people know the seriousness of what's going on in the world. And she said something that was very interesting to me. She said she wants people to talk. And I feel like I would kind of tweak that in a sense with being in 2020. And it's about action. It's about physically going out and physically doing something. And I think that there's been a generational shift with this generation, and we're tired and we're not going to deal with it. And she knows the people that she's around. And I love her response when she said, "What did you get out of it?" And that to me was huge. It's because it's our friends that we need to step up. It's the people that are around us, that are playing with us, our teammates that are not Black, our teammates that love us every day when we put on that jersey and compete with them. But it's about what they think. It's about what they feel. If they can hear us cry out and speak out about it and go home and be with a racist family member, the message isn't being clear. And I love that she mentioned that it's about how the world see it, non-African American people that are not being oppressed, how they respond to it.
Mm. Maxwell, you shared Naomi's picture on your Twitter feed. Why?
Absolutely. For one, You know, it's extremely admirable how Naomi has spoken up and really how the WNBA has been leaders in this movement. I mean, when you think about women in sports, they deal with a whole nother layer of adversity. They have to deal with misogyny. They have to deal with hypermasculinity, people constantly telling them that they shouldn't be playing the sport, which is just completely blasphemous. So there's so many additional things that they have to encounter and deal with outside of being, especially women of color in sports. So I really do tip my hat off to them. And I am trying extremely hard to match that energy and be in support, even when support there can be scarce sometimes.
Dave, let me put this to you from YouTube. This is from Mohammed Wajahat. How much can sports change racism in America?
Well, when I hear that question, I think about what Dr. Martin Luther King said about Jackie Robinson, who called him a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. Jackie Robinson integrates Major League Baseball in 1947, almost a full decade before the flowering of the Montgomery bus boycott and the civil rights movement in the South. A sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. Oftentimes, sports is like a weather vane in our society, and it tells us which way the wind is blowing. And sure enough, right now, what we're seeing is the wind blowing towards justice. The wind is blowing towards some sort of reckoning with the history of racism, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. This is a global movement. And I think what you're seeing, what's so incredible about this, is that what it does is it punctures privilege. Because it's very easy to be a white person in the United States, or I guess anywhere throughout the world, and not have to confront the reality of what it means to be black. Not have to confront the reality of what it means to be an indigenous person. And when you have sports athletes, when you have them speaking out about these issues, it punctures that privilege, it severs that segregation, and it forces people to really confront the realities that people, I mean, that's what Naomi Osaka was doing. She was saying, look, if you're a tennis fan, you might have the luxury of not knowing who Elijah McClain is, but I'm going to put that name in front of you. You are going to know who Elijah McClain is. And that's powerful, but that's also why athletes, I would argue, are policed so heavily by the reactionary powers that be, because they don't want them using that power precisely because they understand how powerful it is.
Dave Zirin reminding us about Elijah McClain, a young black man who died after being stopped and violently restrained by police in Aurora, Colorado. One of the most honest and raw conversations that I've had on the stream happened last year, after the England football team lost to Italy in the UEFA European Championship. In a tense penalty shootout, three black England players missed the goal. The racial harassment and abuse they faced from some fans was so bad it made headlines for weeks. Former professional football player and Arsenal Fan TV presenter CJ Thomas joined the stream to talk about it.
There were so many players that looked like me and I looked up to, and I thought, this is something different. This is an England team I've never been able to associate myself with so deeply. And then again, we lost, and we went from heroes, everyone cheering on the black players, to the villains and getting reminded about our skin colour, as it seems to be the story all the time. And I'm tired of it. I really am.
I'm going to show a moment, because you were covering the Euros for Don Robbie, and this is on YouTube. So I'm just going to show a moment where the premise for this show happened. Like, you see this. This is when it happened. Yeah. Let's have a look. Oh, it's painful to play this, but let's go.
Pickford saved it. Suckers now, suckers now, suckers now, suckers now. Come on, sucker. Come on, sucker. Come on.
Sucker has to score.
CJ, you can be disappointed with your team's performance, but why be racist?
Exactly. Femi, oh, I wish I had the answer to that.
Right?
I always say you can be critical, never personal. That I always say that you can be critical of your team. Like you said, I work at AFTV. It's very much part of my job to criticise the team and analyse and have my opinion, but I'm never, ever personal. And I even said at the end of that video that you all just watched there, I said in my outro, I said, It's awful that the players missed a penalty, three of them being black, but I pray and pray that there's no racial abuse after this. And lo and behold, the next morning I wake up and all the players have been racially abused. Players like Marcus Rashford, who I said again, helped feed the country. He's someone I work very close with. I'm his body double. I do a lot of his campaigns. He is an absolute gent. He's a role model, a superhero, in my opinion. That's what he is to me. He's a superhero. And he's a role model to many kids. And I know it would be devastating to have seen his mural be defaced and words like the N-word put on it and go back to your country. Yeah. Yes, there's been great support since that, but it's not needed, Femi. It's awful.
So let me just look at this. This is the Marcus Rashford mural, which is a beautiful mural. They covered up. They covered up the curse words pretty quickly and the insults pretty quickly. This conversation is not just about the ugliness, though, that comes out of football. I would be remiss if I didn't show this, right? This is incredible. Look at all of these people here. Black Lives Matter, England, Three Lions, and all of these people saying what is happening in England right now with racism against English players born here. That's not right. Does that balance out your mood? Does it balance out the country?
Femi, I'm going to be honest.
CJ?
I wish it did. Yeah. I really wish it did.
Right.
I really wish it did because it looks all lovely now. And you know what? It looked all lovely when we was in the semi-finals and we was winning. But we'll always be reminded of our colour when things aren't going well. And it all looks good, everyone coming together for it. It is a nice gesture and it's nice to see people come together. But people came together for the Black Lives Matter movement, but nothing's changed. There's nothing's changed. And that's the real truth of it all. Will change really happen? In my opinion, no. Raheem Sterling got asked the same question. Have things improved since you stood up to racism in football? And he was honest. I'm glad he was. He said no as well. There's millions of campaigns out there right now. Stop Online Hate, Hope United, Stand Up to Racism, Show Racism a Red Card, Kick It Out. But if I'm honest, if it's not affecting the country's pockets or people's pockets, it's not going to change. I was last on here speaking about the Super League. Look how fast and how quick that went down.
That was fast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you imagine if the fans said, we are not going to deal with racism anymore, and they came out the same way they did for the Super League?
Imagine!
We'd be done!
Imagine.
We'd have nothing more to talk about. Okay, here we are on YouTube. This is Anthony Brown. Racism has always been here. I'm assuming, Anthony, you're in the UK. It's normal.
Do you know how awful that comment is, but how truthful it is?
Right.
He's right. I expected it. When Saka missed the last penalty in the game against Italy, I expected it. I shouldn't expect it. I was scared to travel home from London, from the capital, to go back to my house after that penalty miss. And I should never feel like that. Mm. I was born here. But he's right there. It's normal. Racism is normal in this country. It's embedded in the pillars of football culture, in my opinion. Football fan culture, sorry. And the UK. It's sad. But all we can do is speak about it, because right now I don't see any changes happening.
I'm going to bring in my colleague, Richelle Carey, here, who hosted a stream episode about racism in English cricket. We joined the conversation just as Richelle talks about the excuses often made for not addressing racism in sport.
I think this is a problem that is prevalent in a lot of sports. In the NFL, the National Football League in the U.S., the first thing you'll hear about when there isn't a black head coach is, well, there weren't enough assistants. We didn't have the pipeline. Well, you could fix that if you want to fix the pipeline. Clearly, there is a talent pool for cricket not to be as white as it is. This is a choice people are making, Lee.
Yeah, what worries me is that people in sport, running sport, know they need to fix things now because their backs are against the wall. So there is some good that will come out of this, because some things will be fixed. I mean, it's extraordinary that the murder of a black man in America and the protests, a lot of the protests happened around sport. Only that could lead to any action. And as Alex said, then Yorkshire weren't even taking any notice of that at all. And their case is actually that they're in isolation. But what worries me is around Yorkshire, so the English Cricket Board, you know, they've had a diverse team on the field in a World Cup semi-final against New Zealand. They're bringing through a new game that's more inclusive in terms of gender and families as well as race, called The 100. So some of the stuff they're doing is working. But what about that past decade? And are some of the administrators still in power? And what were they doing at the time? What gets me... So Al Jazeera made a programme about the lack of black football coaches globally that I was heavily involved with. We made that in 2015. Who else? I mean, Al Jazeera has a lot of diversity in its newsrooms and its production. Who else was making programs then? So you've still got the same administrators, the same people in the boardroom making these decisions, and a lot of them, this is the key word for me, cosmetic. There's a lot of cosmetic changes. Is the culture changing?
What you're describing is institutional. I mean, what you're saying is that this is something that its very foundation needs to change. It's not just shifting people here and there, or people that look the way you want them to look for what your cause is. Right, Alex?
Yeah, I feel, and Lee makes a great point. I've always said, unless people always say they want to have change and make change and they put lip service out, people are sick and tired of it now. They've had enough. But when you look at the top, and I'm talking about the boardroom level now, and you walk in, it is predominantly white, middle-aged or older men that are in charge. And we are not privy to what happens in those meetings, but you can sort of have a guess of the conversations that are going on in there. And sort of just going back to your point about, you know, especially with the Asian guys, you know, playing cricket. Listen, where I grew up in Ellsfield, okay, in Wandsworth in South London, and the cricket club that I was affiliated with, honestly, about 80%. Asian guys, and they play representative age group stuff. But as Sad says, you do not see that transferred when it comes to contracts. You just do not see it. You'll see them being used, playing in second team games, and they're doing well, just as good as their white counterparts. But when it comes to that contract, they're not getting it. And for me, that's unfair. And, you know, as a black man playing, you know, the majority of black kids would have had that conversation with their dad or their parents that you have to be twice as good if you're going to get that opportunity.
How many black cricketers have played for England since you played for them 20 years ago? How many black cricketers for England? And is
well,
that
I can name them. I can name them. You know, it's, what, four or five? Hmm. You know, Chris Jordan, Jofra Archer, Tymal Mills. I mean, not many at all, you know. There's only, I think, seven or eight playing in first-class cricket at the moment. When I played in the 90s, every county had at least three or four. So as a young black man, I'm looking and thinking, OK, it's not a close shot. There is an opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to give it a go. If you look now, and I work in the school, if you look now, and obviously, you know, you have to have, you know, Sky or whatever to watch international cricket. The kids are not seeing it. You know, the kids that you're trying to entice to this great game are not seeing it.
Former English cricketer Alex Tudor and journalist Lee Wellings. Finally, people of colour who love snow sports. They're a tiny minority, but they're making skiing and snowboarding more inclusive. Now, I learned to ski as a teen in Italy, and this is my first ski lift pass. No laughing, it was a long time ago. Two things I remember from this trip. The locals staring at a little brown girl on the slopes and the presentation that I had to put together to persuade my Nigerian parents to let me go skiing with my classmates. Experiences that guest Winona Bunyeh could totally relate to.
So we have similar backgrounds. So my parents are from Ghana.
Yeah.
So I know all
next
about
door.
What you
we're
have
cousins.
To go to. Yeah. We're next door. We're, you know.
Yeah.
So I know it all about how you felt in terms of like having to convince them that it was normal to, you know, propel yourself down a mountain at, you know, sometimes 50 miles per hour. But at first I didn't actually tell them that I was going. I just, you know, did it, and then I came back. I told them, oh look, Mom, this is where I've been, and. Now she even wants to come skiing herself, but I definitely recognise that there's a lot of stereotypes and a lot of, even in the black community, about what it's like to be, you know, go skiing. The first thing I say to people, you know, I like skiing, and they're like, really? It's cold, isn't it? Like, we don't do that. Black people don't do that.
Yeah.
That's not for us.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of stereotypes within the community. African parents are another sort of ball game. People have fears of it being a dangerous sport, or, you know, too expensive or it's only for white people. And those are the, you know, it's not the case because you've got three people sitting here who love skiing and snowboarding. So I definitely understand, but definitely need to break down these barriers.
Oh, my director just told me he snowballs. We've got a little black and brown club going on right here, a little ski club going on here. I'm just looking at my laptop, Emily, and these figures really say pretty much everything about the US people of colour who ski. So 87.5% are white, then 6% Asian, 5% Latino or Latina, 1.5% black, 1.8% another, 7% indigenous. You will see that this doesn't all add up to 100 because some people are in more than one category, okay? But the point is that up here are the majority of people who ski and they're not people of colour. Emily, how does that impact you when you are on the slopes?
Yeah, I would say it empowers me to be present and take up space. You know, it's no accident that skiing and snow sports are predominantly white, just due to the pattern of settlement that occurred in the U.S. with redlining and forced migration and exclusion from natural areas and parks. And so it really is about going and reclaiming space. And I'm sure, Lamont, you can probably agree.
100%, 100%. I look at those figures. As Blacks, we're 14% of the population in the United States. And when I've gone to mountains over the years, I kind of, quite frankly, accepted the fact that it was a white majority sport and that I was amongst the super minority in that space. But after a while, I started to question that. And instead of just accepting it, figure, you know, what do I have to say about it? What can I do about it? And that's why I created the Skiing in Color collection. And I'm pleased with the reaction. There's been a lot of people I didn't realize were having this conversation prior to me painting the pieces that I have. And I'm super happy that I can be just one voice in this narrative, like Emily said, to reclaim spaces, to renormalize and recondition where we think we belong or where others feel like we belong, just to change that narrative and flip the status quo.
Lamont, I'm going to show some of your pictures off here, and I'll show some more in a moment. So the picture just to the side of me here, this is you reclaiming spaces so that it's okay for you to ski if you're black or snowboard if you're black. A beautiful one piece here, a sister in a one piece. And then this picture here of the gent skiing, it looks like a photograph. It's so beautiful. So this is some of your work where you're showing off images that people don't normally get to see when they're on the slopes or not so much. What difference does that make, Lamont, do you think?
Well, like it's often said, if you see it, you can be it. I'm a strong believer in representation. Yeah. My role is to exercise representation through my artwork. It's going to take a lot of voices to change the narrative. I've been told by many people as they've discovered me in this space that it's a long road, and I immediately let them know that that's fine. Black and brown people are used to long roads. I'm not going anywhere. Right now I'm in a place where I'm promoting the narrative of changing what is normal in outdoor spaces, mountain spaces, in nature and whatnot. And one day I hope to be just presenting images that are maintaining diversity that's lacking. So quite frankly, if we can invite black and brown people into nature more often, nature will take care of us and we'll in turn take care of nature.
I'm just going to show some. And, go ahead, Emily. You keep talking. I'm going to show some of Lamont pictures.
I completely agree.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, as Lamont is saying, this is about developing a connection with your inner self as well as the natural world. You know, it is really important. Black and brown people make up a significant part of the population globally. And, you know, we're in the midst of a climate crisis. We need to start building connection and reclaiming this space because this is important to our own survival.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for watching.